This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
One is at least violating the Espionage Act, also making false statements, and conspiring to obstruct justice.
That's Steve Herman, VOA chief national correspondent, on the charges former U.S. President Donald Trump faces. Details coming up. Also, Guinea-Bissau's opposition coalition wins the legislative election. And a VOA reporter recounts how he managed to get from Khartoum to Juba. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A coalition of opposition groups won a majority of seats in Guinea-Bissau's parliament, beating the ruling party in the country's first legislative election since the president dissolved the National People's Assembly more than a year ago. To brief us on the latest, I talked to Alvaro Andrade, managing editor of VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, who is closely following events from the capital, Bissau.
Yes, this announcement of the election results, which gave victory to the opposition coalition, brought some relief to the country in Bissau, which had been experiencing a tense calm since Sunday, the election day. The reactions of the president of the Republic, Umaru Sissoko Embalo, and the leader of Madame G15, the ruling party, surprised, but were very well received by Guineans, who took to the street to celebrate the victory of the coalition. Both said they accept the results, and the president has changed his initial position and said he will accept the name of the opposition leader, Domingos Simões Pereira, the former prime minister, if he is nominated by the Pai Teloranga coalition.
President Umaro Sissoko Embalo, he used to crack down on civic freedoms, and he dissolved the parliament in May 2022, postponed the legislative election scheduled at that time, and now he is very supportive. It's a totally different person.
Yes, it completely surprised the reaction, because this position of the president is being analyzed by political observers as a result of a lot of pressure, a pressure for international institutions, especially the ECOWAS and the African Union, which have asked for respect for the result. The chief of their mission, the former president of Cabo Verde, Jorge Cas Fonseca, from ECOWAS, and the former Mozambican president, Joaquim Chissano, from the African Union, called the president and the political leaders to accept the results. I spoke with some political observers that say that the reason for this change in attitude by Sissoko Embalo is also due to the fact that he leaves the ECOWAS presidency next month, and the crisis facing the Senegalese president, Macky Sall, who has been his political godfather in the last 3 or 4 years. The African Union Peace Commissioner, Bankole Adoye, also met with the president Monday, I think it was Monday, and he said at the end, he was spoken with journalists, that the African Union maintains its policy of zero tolerance against any illegal amendment of the constitution or coup d'etat. There was a lot of pressure on the National Electoral Council, which in the 2019 presidential election changed the election results. Now, that didn't happen. Even the ECOWAS head of mission met with the commission on Wednesday before the results and asked that the results be announced as soon as possible to reduce tension in Bissau.
Overall, the mood. Guinea-Bissau, as you know, is a small nation that has gained independence from Portugal nearly 5 decades ago. The country has endured countless political turmoil, including multiple coups. So right now, you are there. How is the mood as far as this current legislative election is concerned?
Hope. The hope, because I spoke with a lot of residents, and they told me 50 years after independence, it's time to have some peace and to prepare a development for this country, because it's a rich country. They have the sea, they have national resources, they have a good land, and they need just to work and to have a government which can finish his term, their terms, and prepare a country for the new level of development. This is the point of Guinea-Bissau now. A lot of hope, but some skepticism also. Maybe what's gonna happen after the first measure from the next government.
That was Alvaro Andredi, managing editor of VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. He talked to me from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. With the number of people living in cities projected to rise to 5 billion by 2030, experts say it is critical that efficient urban planning and management practices are in place to deal with the challenges brought by urbanization. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Participants at the second United Nations Habitat Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya, say city planners and governments need to adopt the UN's New Urban Agenda, a global framework on how to guide and track urbanization. Speaking on the sidelines of the high-level meeting this week, UN officials said the New Urban Agenda provides the policies and standards required to transform the way we sustainably build, operate, and live in our cities. Paula Penanen Ribeiro is a human settlements officer at the United Nations Human Settlements Program, or UN Habitat. She says the recommended standards give national and city governments guidelines for sustainable cities. In Lesotho, a collaboration between UN Habitat and the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa is allowing the country to promote sustainable urban development, as Ribeiro explains.
In Maseru, we've realized that together with the Maseru authorities and with the national government of Lesotho, that their key issue has been the so weak urban data. But now, if Lesotho wants to progress on the new urban agenda implementation, where are they actually starting from? Data is so essential for this. Without agreed on key data on urban development progress tracking, it's very difficult to say whether you are on the right track or not. And this was really the case of Lesotho, which truly would apply to many, many African cities.
As cities grow larger, they face problems with poorly built and overcrowded housing that is built too close to flood zones, highways, or trash dumps. The crowding also adds to pollution and public health risks. The new framework, agreed upon by UN member states, emphasizes the important role of local and regional governments to ensure the creation of better, safer, and resilient cities. Lara Kinnear is an associate professor at the London Interdisciplinary School and a consultant with UN Habitat.
It's really important that people are convening to address how the agenda, the new urban agenda, and all the other agendas that are to do with economic crisis or the climate crisis, how those agendas have to become actions. They can no longer be words on a page. We have solutions. They have been on the table for quite a while. But now is the moment for people to embrace and ensure that they can start acting on it tomorrow, not at the next assembly.
Jacob Ngumi is the chief executive of the Kenya-based non-profit organization called Young Professionals for Development.
The planners in cities in Africa need to manage land governance. Land management is an issue. Zoning cities, land for industry, land for settlements, and land for commercial enterprises. We also need to plan with a green mind, green technologies and green environments to green the cities so that the cities can be friendly.
In most African cities, essential services such as water and electricity supplies, as well as resources such as healthcare and education, are already strained, with migration increasingly leading to the growth of informal settlements. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But we can use this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad I caught it. A federal grand jury in southern U.S. state of Florida indicted President Donald Trump over his retention of sensitive government, and we'll come to that story in a few minutes. But VOA reporter who worked out of Sudan for many years managed to escape the violence in Khartoum via Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Michael Atit tells South Sudan in Focus editor Charlton Doki in Juba his journey from Khartoum, Port Sudan, Jeddah and Cairo was dangerous.
The situation in Khartoum, it's just horrific. I myself and many others have seen horrific things because the fighting took everyone in Khartoum by surprise. So there were reports of dead bodies, there were reports of people being killed, even people who happened to, you know, to be in between crossfire. And even from both the military and the rapid support forces, no one was able to, like, go and collect the dead body and bury them. So they stayed there for quite some days.
Who was controlling which areas or which installations at the time that you were still in Khartoum?
Okay, it was very difficult to identify this situation because of the intensified fighting and because of the restriction of the movement. Each one of the side in the media and the social media could claim, we have captured this place and these are the pictures of the other enemy, you know, and trying to just give this picture to Sudanese or to the people outside.
Let us talk about how you ended up in Port Sudan. Can you describe your journey from Khartoum to Port Sudan?
To be frank, the journey was a risk journey. I didn't know anyone in Port Sudan, and the situation in Khartoum was not conducive anymore for me to be in Khartoum or to continue working in Khartoum. So I had to find a way to get out of Khartoum. I first thought of coming through southward, like to Kostian Rank. It was also not possible from the area where I am. So I decided to go to Port Sudan. I took a normal bus and went to Port Sudan. There were many roadblocks, of course. During this such kind of a period of fighting, there are a lot of roadblocks. So some were there were friendly, some were aggressive, but we have to comply with every demand that they do. Reaching Port Sudan were a little bit peaceful and congested as well, because many of these diplomatic missions and foreigners, they were packed in Port Sudan. That is apart of the Sudanese themselves. There were no place to stay. All the hotels were occupied, all the apartments, even the prices went up.
And Michael, how did you manage to travel to Juba from Port Sudan?
it is also a very long journey. I, through some friends, I was able to provide with air ticket. I went to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. We arrived there at around 10:15 p.m. And we have to stay up to the morning, like at around 6:15, 6:30. This is when I boarded Egypt Air from Jeddah to Egypt, to Cairo, and then wait there for another 3 to 4 hours. From Egypt now, I made it to Juba a few days ago. So it is not easy. It is costly, and I also pity some South Sudanese who are still stranded in Port Sudan, because such kind of a journey, if you don't have cash, if you don't have money, you cannot make it.
At the moment, are you in touch with people in Khartoum, family, friends in Khartoum, and what are they telling you?
Yes, I'm in touch with so many friends and family members also in Khartoum. 2-3 days ago, there was this heavy fighting around the ammunition factory and the, you know, storage of the fuel. So you could imagine how the situation is. So people are, you know, trying to get out of that area. But then also some are telling a lot of stories, you know, with the encountering checkpoints along the road as they make it to Medeni, to Al Jazeera State, or they make it to White Nile State in Kosti. There are a lot of incidents happening along the way, looting, you know, people being checked, taking phones and looting money. And families, and a lot of families lost a lot of items along that road.
And that was South Sudan in Focus, Michael Atit, speaking with editor Charlton Doki in Juba about his experience during Sudan's conflict. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com.
There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. In the United States, an indictment of federal charges against former President Donald Trump has been released. He faces 37 counts of mishandling, classified documents, and other charges. His aide, Walt Nauta, also has been charged. The charges include of willful retention of national defense information, making false statements and representations, conspiracy to obstruct justice, withholding a document or record, corruptly concealing a document in a federal investigation, and a scheme to conceal. The indictment of former President Donald Trump is a historical development in the U.S. and is drawing attention around the world. For more about the significance of this indictment and how it may be perceived in Africa, VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York.
I think it's a very difficult position for the country, for the United States. Let's not forget that this is a one-of-a-kind event. It's the first time a former president has been indicted federally. Let's also not forget that Trump was indicted here in New York, here in Manhattan. So it's a very challenging situation. I think the other element to this is it's very much a hotbed issue because of the politics and the legal consequences of this situation. Trump's leading candidate on the Republican side for nomination to the presidency, but he is also facing serious legal challenges. So these two issues are going to go in tandem as we go towards the elections for next year.
Looking at this indictment from an African angle, what do you think Africans should take from it?
Two very important points, that nobody is above the law, but also nobody is under the law. And by that, I mean, whatever your portfolio or your standing in a society, in the U.S. system, whether you are a president, a top general, you have to face the law as a citizen. But at the same time, even when somebody is accused, in the case, for example, of Donald Trump, this indictment is not a judgment. It just means he has a case to answer. And by that, I say nobody is under the law, which means everybody has their due process right. I think from an African perspective, that's very important to remember. That is, the high and mighty also have to face the law. But even as the high and mighty face the law, or common citizens face the law, that they have their rights. They cannot be under the law. The law cannot be used to victimize people. Everyone needs a fair trial.
There are some countries in Africa where opposition leaders are normally harassed and charged with this offense and the other as a way of stopping them from competing for the presidency. Could that be seen in that way, in that light?
So this is a difficult question, but I think if you really look at the legal process, at least in the case of Donald Trump, the law has been followed, which means his Fifth Amendment, which is his due process rights, have been respected. Let's not forget a special counsel was appointed for this investigation, so that it would not appear that the government is attacking Trump and trying to remove him from the being a candidate. This was something, the legal and political processes were separated through the special counsel that decided to look at this indictment. But I think the third aspect of this, which are the legal protections of the accused Donald Trump in this case, is there's a grand jury which was put together to see Trump has a case to answer. And basically what a grand jury is a random group of citizens, common people, who are brought together to look at the evidence in a case and decide whether someone has a case to answer, in this case, Donald Trump. So that whole legal process has been followed. As much as Trump wants to politicize this, his due process rights have been followed, and he has a case to answer, and he will have his attorney, and he will have his day in court. So I really do not see it as a case of a weaponization of the judiciary because due process has been followed. And if Trump is acquitted or if Trump is convicted, the law has been upheld.
That was David Mondo, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from New York. The Vatican said today that Pope Francis has started working again after spending another good night in a hospital following hernia surgery. Francis, 86, underwent a three-hour operation at the Gemelli Hospital in Rome on Wednesday and was said to be cheerful when he woke up. The Vatican said the head of the Catholic Church had breakfast Friday before spending most of the morning in an armchair rather than in bed, which allowed him to start doing some work. In 2021, he underwent surgery at the Gemelli for an inflammation of small bulges that can develop in the lining of the intestine. His doctors say this time the pontiff has been suffering from a hernia on the site of a scar from a previous operation. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the past year, over 100 armed conflicts raged around the world, according to a United Nations report issued in early May. And as the average duration of such conflicts stands at more than 30 years, civilians have continued to endure profound and lasting hardship. In 2022, the United Nations recorded nearly 17,000 civilian deaths across 12 armed conflicts, a 53% increase compared with 2021, said U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. In Ukraine alone, the UN recorded almost 8,000 civilian deaths, although actual figures are likely higher. This is the human cost of Russia's unprovoked, brutal war of aggression in Ukraine.
This war has also had a devastating impact on vulnerable populations in countries far from Ukraine. Millions and millions more people have been pushed into food insecurity as a result of this conflict. Why? Because Russia has used food as a weapon of war in Ukraine.
There is also an ongoing need to protect and aid those who have been forced from their homes, unsure when or if they will be able to return, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
More than 100 million people have been forcibly displaced as a result of conflict, violence, persecution, human rights violations, and abuses. Burkina Faso, Somalia, Burma, and Ukraine face some of the fastest growing displacement crises. And according to the UN Refugee Agency, fighting in Sudan could displace an additional 1 million people.
We must all do more to stamp out hunger and to save lives, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. At the same time, we must all recognize that no amount of aid will meet the needs of the world's most vulnerable if it cannot reach the world's most vulnerable.
Too often, warring parties intentionally block humanitarian access, and too often, the very people who dedicate their lives to saving others are targeted. Last year, more than 250 humanitarian and healthcare workers were killed. Many others were injured, assaulted, or kidnapped. The kidnapping of medical personnel continues across conflicts. Targeting aid workers is a clear violation of international humanitarian law and must be roundly and universally condemned.
We must do more together to protect civilians facing armed conflict, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. We must see our common humanity in those that are suffering. Let us do everything in our power to alleviate that suffering and to secure a more peaceful and just future for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.